And joining us on the book club today is award-winning journalist and author Daniel Devizet. Daniel's latest book is King of Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. And we're going to talk a little bit about that book in just a minute. But before we get talking about Daniel and some of the things that he's accomplished, we'd like to take the time to welcome Daniel to the show. Daniel, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. It's an honor.
So let's talk a little bit about your background. Growing up, were you always interested in writing? And in, I don't want to say just music, because you've written some other books that are not necessarily about music. But tell us a little bit about how you got into books, writing, all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, if I had to pick what are my two or three big things that I've been into in my life, writing obviously is what has paid the bills. And then music is a huge passion. I took the piano from like age five and learned to read music. I played in orchestras all through high school and actually considered going into classical music as a profession until I changed my mind. And then I played in cover bands for years in Florida and in L.A. and in the D.C. area. I have a Gibson Les Paul behind the piano that's, you know, the whole back of it's worn off just from the number of gigs that I did on it. I'm not a great musician, but I always felt like I had a good ear. I could always count on that. Like I could figure out the chords in a song or what the harmony is supposed to be. So yeah, and I'd never been able to do the music beat as a writer at a newspaper. It's a hard beat to get. People hold on to that beat if they get it. So I was always kind of a frustrated music writer. So when the opportunity arose for me to write a book about music, I certainly seized it.
And it definitely shows that you have a musical background, because the way it's written, you can tell right away just what you understand.
Oh, thank you.
But then the reader as well, you don't have to know music, because if you read this book, you lead us and guide us through a lot of what some people might consider, well, you know, I'm not a musician, so I don't understand that. But that's not the case in this book. Again, the book is King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. Tell us about your newspaper reporting. You did tell us you shared a Pulitzer Prize. If you wouldn't mind telling us about your career as a journalist, as a writer, with I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, gosh, the newspaper business is fascinating. It's this, there's this arc, like a story arc of newspapers, and I think that they peaked in circulation at a certain point. I don't even remember when that was. But my wife and I got into the news business in 1990, which I think is maybe the beginning of the downward slide in the number of, you know, print circulation for each paper. And papers started closing, and the business started tightening. And so the whole decade of the 90s and the 2000s and into the 2010s, I was in the business. And it was tough. I felt like I had to keep leaping to bigger and bigger papers in order to kind of stay afloat, because the smaller ones were starting to go under. But that's the sad part. The happy part is it was wonderful, wonderful work. If anybody listening to this ever worked on a small paper, you get to do a little bit of everything from the obits to like night cops to, you know, Edna Buchanan type stuff where you're like writing gripping stories about a murder, the weather page, everything, cop checks. And I did all that stuff at my first job in Boca Raton, Florida. And then I worked in Long Beach, California at the paper there, which was big enough, you know, that I had a beat and all that, and did fewer things, but did many, many articles. And then I went from there to the San Diego paper, did a run there, and then the Miami Herald for 7 years, and then the Washington Post for, I think, about 8 years. And I in hindsight, I left at a good time, because now the Post is thriving. You know, Jeff Bezos came up with a new business model where you focus mostly on digital, and they have a massive digital audience now that I think I gather supports them. And then they have a dwindling print product, and that makes them, I mean, that's like every other paper in the country. The print circulation is plummeting. But I'm not unhappy about the fact that I'm not having to deal with that as a workplace issue of trying to stay employed, you know, in with the dwindling readership, you know, figures.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist and author Daniel Devizet. His latest book is King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. Now, some people might say, well, Daniel, you worked as a reporter, you worked in a newspaper, and so it should be rather easy to write a book, but that's not the case. You can't really switch gears like that.
Well, a book is very daunting. The way I looked at it when I started doing my first book, which was co-written, I had a co-author. It was a memoir about amnesia, and my co-writer was the amnesiac, and so I was helping her to remember her life. And I remember coaching her and coaching myself that we would break it up into chapters. And once you think of a book as chapters, each one could be like its own story, and that makes it a little less daunting because I can write a 5,000 or 7,000-word story. I'd done that before. So I just did a whole bunch of those, and that became the book. And I used the same technique with my book about Andy Griffith and Don Knotts. I wrote it one chapter at a time. That breaks the project down and makes it more digestible, I guess. And to this day, that's kind of how I operate.
That is one of the books, I'm glad you mentioned it, Andy and Don, The Making of a Friendship and a Classic TV Show. I'm not sure there's anybody out there who has never seen a little bit of an Andy Griffith clip. And this was a very interesting book.
It's my greatest hit. It's still selling pretty good, I'm happy to say. And I can't say who, but somebody just ordered a few hundred copies just now, like a week ago, for a prominent nonprofit. You know, the book is still selling. It's just the story of a great guy friendship between the real-life Andy Griffith and the real-life Don Knotts. Don was my brother-in-law, so I had some entree into that. And I just told the story of their beautiful friendship over many decades.
When I read that, Don was your brother-in-law. Looking back at his upbringing, he had a pretty rough childhood, especially with his dad.
They both did. Probably Don especially in Morgantown, West Virginia, which is a college town, so that sounds great. But the father was a schizophrenic, and the mother was supporting the family, and they lived in a rooming house and rented all the rooms out, and Don slept in the kitchen. And I can imagine what that must have been like. And his like drunken brothers would come home after a night of partying and like want to make eggs, and there's Don trying to sleep. He had a rough upbringing. Andy did better because he was an only child in Mount Airy, North Carolina. But even at that, he was on, as he described it, the wrong side of the tracks and was from the poor side of town. I think his father was a furniture factory foreman. So he did a little better as far as having food on the table and clothes on his back. But they both had tough upbringings.
And what about, the classic TV series, The Andy Griffith Show, was very successful. As I mentioned, just about anybody has seen it, at least a clip of it. But when we bring down the characters, and as you mentioned in this book, Andy and Don were very close friends. But what about the rest of the cast? What people may wonder about, because there have been some stories about Beatrice Bouvier, Aunt B, who was very indifferent to some of the other people in the cast, on the cast.
Well, she was older than, not than all of them, but somewhat older and more serious. I picture her as like a Margaret Dumont character, if that woman from the Marx Brothers, the straight person among the silly people. I don't think that's too far off. She was serious, took her craft very seriously, and the rest of them were all being goofballs, you know, just practical jokes, playing music, not getting drunk, not during the working hours, but they were a bunch of goofballs and mostly guys. And Frances Bavier, bless her heart, was a serious actress. And the only one who really got her was Jim Nabors, Gomer Pyle. They would go antiquing together. He was more thoughtful and sensitive, I think, to her seriousness, her sobriety, and she didn't like the cursing. She didn't like the running around and making noise. a lot's been made of that. I mean, the fact is, Andy ran a benevolent dictatorship in that show. People loved coming to work there. He made it a wonderful, wonderful workplace. I would have given anything to be a part of that. I mean, what a wonderful production. And I'll make my pitch. I think The Andy Griffith Show is the most enduring television show from the entire black and white era of television and probably beyond. There's no other program, even Lucy or The Honeymooners, that people so regularly go back and actually watch, you know, every single day. It's that important, I think.
And it's one of those programs also where people know the name of each particular character and almost the name of each particular episode and what happens.
Oh, better than I do. better than I do. I watched most of the episodes when I wrote my book. I felt like I had to, and I loved it. I'd watched them all when I was a kid on WGN in Chicago. But no, there's people who know that show chapter, line, and verse, and they gather every year in Mount Airy for Mayberry Days, which brings together, I don't know, 20, 30,000 people to celebrate the legacy of the show. That was my initial goal with the book, which I have long since surpassed, but my goal was to sell as many copies as people who came to the Mayberry Days celebration every year.
We are visiting with Daniel DeVizet. He is the author of King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. And if you're wondering, why the heck are they talking about Andy and Barney? Well, it's because one of his books is
why
Andy
not?
And Don, The Making of Friendship in a Classic TV Show. I'm sure some people might, and if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine. But some people heard you say that Don Knotts was your brother-in-law.
That's right. My dear wife, Sophie, we've been together since 87. Her older sister, Francie, is Don Knotts' widow.
What was it like to have Barney as a brother-in-law?
I saw him especially at the holidays, Easter, Christmas, Thanksgiving. He'd be sitting in a corner kind of by himself. He was very shy, and the family would be sort of buzzing around him, and my wife would actually say, go over and talk to him. You know, he's probably lonely. So I'd go talk to him, and I'm a reporter, so I'll talk to anybody. I've interviewed, you know, Bill Gates, Bill Clinton. So I'd go talk to him, and he told wonderful stories once I got him to open up. And he was just a sweet, wonderful man. Nothing like being
Barney.
At Disney World with Don Knotts. Disney World, the man was like Elvis. I mean, just mobbed. We could not move 2 feet. Everybody wanted to meet him, and of every generation, you know, knew that man and loved him and wanted to meet him. So that was something else. Also, being with him in Vegas was quite an eye-opener. I mean, he could not move around like you or me. Everybody wanted to see him and to get a piece of him, so to speak, but in a very sweet way.
And in some instances, some of these characters, like Michael Landon, will always be known as Little Joe or Charles Ingalls. And Don Knotts, despite the fact that he had some hit movies, he'll always be known as Barney Fife.
Well, I would reduce it further and say he'll always be known as the nervous man. The nervous man was his basic character, and it came to him in a dream. He told me about it one night, you know, in the family house. He dreamed this character, this jittery guy who can barely get a glass of water up to his lips, and he first presented him on the Steve Allen show back in the 50s, and it became his character, his go-to character, and I would say that nervous man was the basis for Barney, the deputy, and was also really the basis for Mr. Furley in Three's Company, and the basis for the character in The Ghost and Mr. Chicken, and the basis for, you know, most of his Disney characters. So I would say that it all reduces to a level even before Barney. It's this nervous man that was the character that Barney, that Don Knotts perfected, and that became the basis of really all of his characters.
We are visiting with Daniel DeVizet. Daniel is the author of the book, King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. And we'd love to talk more about Andy and Don, but we better move on to talk a little bit about your most recent book, King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. This is an incredible book, the fact that you start from literally the cradle to the grave.
It's almost 500 pages, and I hope that won't put anyone off. I tried to fill it as much as I could with storytelling, with scenes like out of a movie, which I think you can get through pretty fast. The print is large in the book. My wife and I saw to that because we have weak eyes. So every copy is a little bit large print, so it's easy to read. And I've heard people say over and over they move through it pretty quick. But yeah, I started at the very beginning, and it's a big life. That's why it's the longest book that I've written.
Well, the way that you wrote it, of course, it's the narrative just flows, and it's like somebody is telling you a story, and it's not like, oh my gosh, this chapter's too long or this chapter is not long enough. It just flows on to the next one. And when we open up, you tell us a little bit about his parents and then also himself, and my gosh, what a tough life. That was like some of the blues songs that we hear.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think that this is one of the most important rags-to-riches stories in American culture. Riley King was born in 1925 to a sharecropping family, an extended family of sharecroppers, and most of them would end each year in debt to the landowner, and that was sharecropping. It was worse than a zero-sum game. You'd end up impoverished at the end of the year. Bibi's father, Albert King, was very hardworking and was kind of the ultimate sort of alpha male provider. And he broke out of that cycle of debt and became a tractor driver, which paid better. So he was actually able to provide for his family. And that was a model to young Riley King. BB himself became a tractor driver and started earning real money. Not a lot, but enough to support himself and his wife. But he had towering ambitions. And once he heard a guitar at his Aunt Mima's cabin, he wanted to be some kind of musical person. And he started first thinking about doing gospel. And he had a gospel, I think, a quintet that actually performed on the radio in WGRM in Greenwood, Mississippi. And that might have been, he might have wound up being a sort of a Sam Cooke character, except that fate intervened and he would be busking on the street corners. And he noticed that if he played a blues song, people would put money in the hat, which they weren't doing for the, they probably figured with the gospel songs that they'd already given in church, right?
Yeah.
So he realized the blues paid better. And I mean, he made no bones about that. That was his choice. He said, well, I'm going to do the blues because I want to earn a living.
And earn a living indeed he did. In this book, you carry us on through, well, as I mentioned, through the grave. We'll talk a little bit about when he got sick and when he passed on. But I liked to go back to the part in the 1980s, well, actually before that, 1967, which was the end of the British invasion with the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and all that. But then we saw people like Jimmy Page, Jimi Hendrix,
yeah,
and Eric Clapton. And these guys were just basically imitating what they learned from B.B. King. At least that's what I interpreted from the book.
Yeah, I think the first British invasion was all about the Beatles and Beatlemania and just this lust, or I don't know what you call it, primal reaction to these boys with the mop tops and their unchastened music. I'm reading a book about the Beatles right now, Hunter Davies' original biography of them, and it was a wild time. There's nothing like it, I guess. But the second British invasion, I would say, was all about B.B. King. And let me explain. It'll take a couple minutes, but I can explain it. B.B. King started playing the guitar on the radio and making records in Memphis around 1949, 1950. And the guitar itself was not popular at that time. You wouldn't have heard a lot of guitar on the radio or on disc. It didn't figure very prominently in music, in pop music or in rhythm and blues. BB then was kind of an unusual character in being a guitarist running a band. So he starts recording, and he creates a signature sound. There wasn't a lot of lead guitar out there. There weren't any guitar heroes, really, to speak of. T-Bone Walker was a rare example of a guitar guy leading a band, and he becomes BB's big influence. But BB King takes the solo guitar style, such as it was in the 40s, and his own signature sound was different. He played the guitar so that it sounded like a human voice. This is where you get Lucille. He kind of gave human qualities to his guitar, and I think he saw it as a Bergen and McCarthy thing where he's like throwing his voice to the guitar, and he played the guitar so it sounded like the vocal sound that he heard in his head. Now, it took a long time because, again, the guitar was not really very important at the time, but by a decade later, 1960, this is a full decade after BB started making music, a younger generation of black electric bluesmen such as Buddy Guy, Albert King, et al., start playing that way and start spreading the sound, this B.B. King guitar sound. And they and their records travel to Europe and to Britain, where all these the people who became the soldiers in the second British invasion are all there. Page, Beck, Clapton, Peter Green from Fleetwood Mac, Dave Gilmour. And they all learned to play that way. Some of them learned directly from BB from his recordings. Others learned from Buddy Guy or the other characters who were basically disciples of the BB King sound. And then they come to America in the second British invasion, 66, 67, led by Jimi Hendrix, who was a sort of expatriate who'd gone to England because of the stupid segregation in American music and launched his career from Britain. He, too, basically played in the BB King style, although I think he's maybe arguably the greater guitarist overall as far as his virtuosity and such. But B.B. King, I think, is ultimately the most important character because he'd created this sound. And so then all the white pop artists in America learned to play like B.B. King. And voila, if you put on any record any record recorded in pop or blues from about 1967 on, chances are there will be a guitarist on it who sounds like B.B. King.
We're visiting with award-winning journalist and author Daniel DeVizet. We are talking about his new book, King of the Blues, The Rise and Fall, Rise and Reign, excuse me, of B.B. King. The book itself, as you talk about him being the true guitar hero and then introducing it to these British musicians, as you mentioned, as you continue in the book, we get to the 80s and then the era of music videos and MTV, and no African-American artists are featured on MTV until Michael Jackson goes on there, and then he does the Billie Jean, and of course later he does Thriller, directed by the great director John Landis. And at some point, Landis talks to B.B. King and says, I want you to play the soundtrack for this. And B.B. King says...
Yeah, it was the introduction of black music to MTV is a huge issue, and that's part of this larger issue of the gradual desegregation of music, right? B.B. King had performed almost exclusively for black audiences all the way up until the second half of the 60s, if you can believe that. Almost no white people knew who he was. But when these British guitarists came back and white listeners in America started listening to them and started discovering Buddy Guy, Otis Rush, Albert King, all these great black blues artists, they finally discovered B.B. King. And his sort of big crossover epiphany is one night in February 1967 at Bill Graham's Fillmore. And it's almost literally the first time that B.B. King performs to a house full of white people, basically. And from that moment on in 1967, he is everybody's, you know, favorite guitarist, not just in the black community. And that's just kind of, and then after that, you get the Stones tour in 69, which opens up a huge new audience. You get the Thrill Is Gone single. He plays on Carson. He plays on Ed Sullivan. And yet, as you discussed, you get to the Blues Brothers era, and John Landis puts him on videos, and he tours a few years after that with U2. And he just reached ever higher rings of fame as a sort of global blues superstar.
One of the things that have been mentioned, and I believe you mentioned it in your book, when he talks about, when you write about the MTV era and Michael Jackson, some people say that there's a big similarity between Big Boss Man and Billie Jean.
Oh, that's right. I'm not sure that anyone other than me noticed this, but I could be wrong. It may be that someone else, that I read that somewhere, but I put that in my book because, yeah, they sound like the same song. And forgive me if someone had before me figured that out, but I just use I follow my ears. And when I hear that song, it sounds like the Michael Jackson song. Yeah, so somebody probably owes Michael Jackson's estate some royalties.
We're visiting with Daniel DeVizet. Daniel is the author of the book King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. As you mentioned, I mentioned earlier, you take us through his whole life, and towards the end, we know that, you know, you write that he is sick, he's getting sick, but what the sad thing about it is that all of a sudden, you see all these, because allegedly, and I say allegedly, he had 24 children, and they all wanted a piece of B.B. King, but there was no way possible that he could have even sired any children.
Well, first of all, let me say that what you're alluding to is it's true. There was a dispute, but he wanted them to have his fortune, very much so. So that was never in dispute. The thing that became kind of newsworthy was, were they really his children or not? Mr. King had always presented his 15 children as his children, full stop, you know, period. Late in his career, starting around, I think, the 90s, reporters started referring to them as biological and adopted. And gradually it became, I guess, known that maybe they weren't all his biological children. A little-known fact was that back in 1980, Charlie Sawyer had written an authorized biography of Mr. King. And in that biography, Mr. Sawyer wrote that B.B. King had gone to a fertility doctor back in the 50s and had been informed that he could not father children. So Mr. Sawyer, in his book, just let that stand and didn't really take it to the logical conclusion, but I did in my book, which is to say that this is why the people closest to Mr. King and his inner circle didn't think that those children were really his biological children. Now, why does it matter to me? Because as his biographer, I know this. I know that B.B. King lost his entire family. He lost his baby brother when he was about 5 years old. His baby brother died, leaving him an only child. Mr. King lost his mother when he was about 10. His mother died. He lost his grandmother, who was his caregiver, when he was about 14. And so he was alone in the world. He felt that way anyway. So he spent his whole adult life basically building a family that he could sort of cherish. And that's kind of a beautiful thing.
And he was married twice, but his second wife, after the divorce, they still became very good friends.
Yeah, he was married twice. And getting back to my last point, neither marriage produced any children, even though they were married in all 16 years. After B.B. divorced Sue in 1966, and she was one of my great sources in the book, I would argue that she was the love of his life all the way to the end. She always had a huge central place in his heart. He would invite her to see him whenever he had a really important gig to do, like if it was in Ireland or a big homecoming in Mississippi, she would be there. And one time they were in Mississippi, and he like serenaded her with "The Thrill Is Gone," and an NPR reporter asked Sue, he said, "Well, Sue, were you the thrill? Are you the thrill? And she said, "I don't know. You got to ask the man." So the reporter went away, and then he came back after having talked to B.B. King, and said, "Yes, Sue, he told me so, that you were the thrill." So we now know that that song was written for her.
We are visiting with award-winning author and journalist Daniel DeVizet. The King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King is his most recent book. You left basically virtually no stone unturned in this, and you interviewed anybody who could have a little bit of information or a lot of information about B.B. King. But what really fascinates me as well is some of these pictures that you included in the book. They're incredible.
Well, it was a great situation because some of the best photos of Mr. King were taken by people who knew him pretty well, and they wound up being my sources too. So there's a bunch of pictures in there by Bill Ferris, the great scholar, who was a huge proponent of B.B. King's career and saw to it that he got an honorary doctorate from Yale. So Bill Ferris's pictures are there. Charlie Sawyer, who wrote the official biography in 1980, a whole bunch of his pictures are in my book. Glenn Craig, who traveled with B.B. extensively and photographed him in the Stones tour, and I interviewed Glenn, his pictures are there. And then Ernest Withers, the famous black Memphis photographer who's kind of legendary, a number of his pictures are there too. So I felt like it's the most meaningful photo book that I've ever done. And when I say photo book, I mean the little 16-page section in the middle, which you can read first before you buy the book. And it's kind of like almost like a comic book version of the book, which I like.
Daniel, thank you so much for being with us. Now, before we leave, is there a webpage or somewhere online that people can go to find out more about this book and your other books?
Oh, yeah. It's just my name, DanielDeVizet.com. But if you type in Andy Don book, or if you type in B.B. King book and any part of my name, it'll come up on the Google. The website includes information on all of my books.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, I am honored. Thank you.
We've been visiting with Daniel DeVizet. He is the author of the book King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King. The book club is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Sam Cassiano. You've been tuned to The Book Club. I'm Louis Sines.